Guatemalan police have rescued 126 mainly Haitian migrants from an abandoned shipping container on the side of a road on Saturday, 9th of October, highlighting how the desperate flow of people from Haiti and across South America has not abated despite the recent wave of United States deportations. Guatemalan authorities said they searched the trailer around dawn after residents heard screams coming from within. The shipping container was found in an area between the towns of Nueva Concepción and Cocales in the country's south. Guatemalan police spokesman Jorge Aguilar told reporters that of the 126 undocumented people found inside the shipping container, 106 were from Haiti, 11 were from Nepal, and 9 were from Ghana, according to an Agence France-Presse report. Guatemalan police suspect that they had paid to be illegally taken to the United States via Mexico by smugglers, who instead abandoned them on the road in southern Guatemala. The treacherous journey appears to have begun in Honduras, said a spokeswoman for Guatemala's Migration Authority, Alejandra Mena. After first aid checks on the migrants and asylum seekers, Guatemalan officials said they would be deported back to Honduras and taken into custody there. Countless migrants and asylum seekers have died or been detained while taking increasingly risky routes to reach the United States. On Thursday, 7th of October, police in Mexico found 652 migrants crammed into six trailers near Mexico's border with the United States. About half of them were children, nearly 200 of whom were not accompanied by any adult. Refugee advocates have been particularly concerned about a recent surge of migrants from Haiti, the Western Hemisphere's poorest nation, that's now also facing the world's highest per capita kidnapping rate. Warring gangs already control significant parts of the country when President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated in July of this year, thrusting the country into further political turmoil. The Biden administration has since backed Haiti's embattled interim prime minister, Ariel Henry, who critics say would be unable to remain in power without Washington's support. Adding to the daily stress of Haitians, a 7.2 magnitude earthquake in August devastated much of the island nation's southwest. Facing increasingly dire conditions at home in Haiti and in South American countries where many Haitians fled after the 2010 earthquake, thousands of Haitian migrants have tried their luck seeking asylum and seeking work in the United States. Many of those who came in recent months said they expected to be allowed in by the Biden administration. But amid a surge at the U.S.-Mexico border, the Biden administration in mid-September began rapidly deporting thousands of Haitians from Texas to Port-au-Prince in Haiti. Some who were sent back said they had not lived in Haiti for decades. Others vowed to continue to try again to enter the United States. The Biden administration invoked a pandemic-related measure, Title 42, to rapidly deport border crossers back to Mexico, to their home countries. Deportees, however, said no systematic coronavirus testing has been conducted, and several reported testing positive for the virus upon arrival in Haiti. Controversy erupted last month after images of horse-mounted Border Patrol agents attempting to grab migrants and push them back over the border into Mexico put the nation's focus on the unfolding humanitarian crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. Once back in Haiti, some recent returnees have become the targets of kidnappers, amid reports that they will be carrying cash. Many of the thousands of Haitians deported in recent weeks remain stranded in Port-au-Prince. Ambassador Daniel Foote, President Biden's former special envoy for Haiti, resigned last month in protest over the U.S. government's policies towards Haitian migrants. Former Ambassador Daniel Foote told members of a House panel on Thursday that the deportation policies were inhumane and would not deter people from trying to reach the United States. Daniel Foote said, "We've always prioritized stability over going after the root causes of instability." Foote told lawmakers. He added, "I believe the root causes of instability are now that the Haitian people do not believe that they have had a voice in their destiny in selecting their leaders."
The Khashoggi case.
In October 2018, the Saudi regime carried out one of the most egregious acts of terrorism in the modern world. As Jamal Khashoggi, a veteran Saudi insider turned mild critic, entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul to collect some documents, he was ambushed by over a dozen Saudi agents and subsequently killed in a gruesome manner. The murder of Jamal Khashoggi was unusual and egregious in several respects. The most unusual and damning feature was it occurred inside Saudi diplomatic premises. The Saudis could have killed him anywhere, but the fact that they chose to murder him inside a diplomatic facility sent out disturbing messages to the world.
But it means we are not safe, because a consulate, this is a consulate. People go to consulate to obtain papers, to renew passports, to get certificates of certain things. I mean, if the Saudi consulate can turn into this, then probably other consulates of similar regimes might do it. And if they can do it in a consulate, they'll probably next time contemplate doing it in the streets or in the road.
The Saudi regime was giving out the message that it either believed it could get away with murder or felt it could deal with the fallout.
He feels he is powerful enough to go beyond this crisis. And he's going to impose his own way and the style of governance, and he's going to buy himself out of it. And definitely he's empowered by his friends in the White House. That's very important, by the way. The only consistent factor in the Saudi strategic understanding of the world is the White House, the Americans, always. So they take that seriously. So you have Trump, you have Jared Kushner, and you have the friendship between them and the interest, of course, that has been built. In my opinion, he feels empowered as long as these guys are there.
The manner of the killing was remarkable, as Khashoggi was hacked and sawed into pieces, and not a shred of him has been found since.
I want to know who gave the order to kill Jamal, and who else knew. I want to know where is his body. I implore you to take action.
But who was Khashoggi, and why did the Saudis kill and dismember him in such a brutal fashion?
Really, Mr. Jamal Khashoggi was not as he seemed on the media, with his husky voice and the serious character. He in the life, he is a funny man, and he wasn't a smoker, but he was preferred to smoke cigar and drink coffee. Or one time he said to me, the Saudis or
the authority in Saudi Arabia treat him as if he shot on the member of royal family and fled outside Saudi Arabia.
Jamal Khashoggi had lived his entire adult life, bar the last few months of his life, within the close circles of the Saudi court. Much has been made of his supposed opposition to the Saudi regime in the last year of his life, but the truth is that even in those final months, he was little more than a mild critic of some aspects of Saudi foreign policy, notably the self-defeating war in Yemen.
Jamal was not a dissident or opposition, as people in the media keep describing him. Jamal was a, loyal, normal Saudi citizen. He was, his main sin is that he was bright, he was a maverick, and he was outspoken. He couldn't hold things back.
Khashoggi opposed the Saudi war on Yemen, not because it killed and maimed Yemeni civilians, but because he saw it as a war that Saudi Arabia could not win. Partly of Turkish origin, Jamal Khashoggi was attracted to a variant of the Muslim Brotherhood in his early adult life. His organizational links with the Brotherhood strengthened when he went to Afghanistan on ostensibly journalistic assignments in the 1980s. Khashoggi was of the opinion that aspects of Brotherhood ideology were compatible with the Wahhabi doctrine of the Saudi state, and throughout his life he tried hard, but in vain, to reconcile the Muslim Brotherhood movement with the Saudi regime. Another important aspect of Khashoggi's biography is that he was a lifelong affiliate of the Saudi Foreign Intelligence Service. This affiliation intensified when he effectively became the right-hand man of Prince Turki bin Faisal, the former veteran chief of Saudi Arabia's Foreign Intelligence Agency. Throughout his life, Khashoggi balanced his journalism with his affiliation to Faisal's agency, all the while appearing as a reformer who was able to soften the regime's edges. And herein lies the value of Khashoggi to the Saudi regime. Khashoggi was at the helm of Saudi Arabia for most of his adult life. He worked for flagship newspapers such as Al-Sharq al-Awsat before being appointed as deputy editor-in-chief of Arab News. He was appointed as editor-in-chief of Saudi daily Al-Watan in 2003, before being dismissed for espousing ostensibly liberal views. He was reappointed to the same role in 2007 and stayed in the post until 2010. The beginning of Khashoggi's separation from the ruling clique of the Al-Sauds can be traced to the shift in power at the top of the Saudi regime, which began in earnest in January 2015 with the death of King Abdullah. The demise of Abdullah, who was widely viewed in the West as a reformist, and his succession by Salman bin Abdulaziz paved the way for the ascent of a younger and more aggressive leadership. The ascent of the aggressive and monopolistic MBS, who officially became the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia in June 2017, spelled the end of Khashoggi's decades-long dalliance with the Saudi regime. At that time, Khashoggi had already been part exiled in the smaller Persian Gulf states, notably Bahrain, where he tried to launch a satellite news channel in vain. But following MBS's consolidation of power, Khashoggi moved to the United States, a move that infuriated MBS and his inner circle. Jamal Khashoggi's murder stands as arguably the worst and most egregious case of state-sanctioned assassination in modern history. Whilst there are plenty of states who are in the business of murdering their opponents outside their borders, few, if any, have considered killing people inside their diplomatic premises. The assassination was also notable for the scale of its planning and the manpower required to do the job. Up to 15 Saudi operatives were waiting for Khashoggi when he entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul on October the 2nd, 2018. Independent investigations say the team was led by Major General Ahmad Asiri, a former intelligence chief and an ally of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Asiri was also a pivotal figure in the Saudi-led war in Yemen. and was also implicated in anti-Iranian intrigues, including a childish plot by the Lebanese-American businessman George Nader to instigate regime change in Iran. At a planning and operational level, the assassination was reportedly directed by Saud al-Qahtani, an established Saudi insider and media consultant to MBS. Prior to Khashoggi's assassination, Qahtani was widely described as a major influence on MBS's domestic and foreign policies. Following Khashoggi's murder, al-Qahtani disappeared from public view, and there are credible reports that he too has been murdered by the Saudi regime. From the outset, the Saudi regime not only denied culpability in Khashoggi's murder, but it denied that the former insider had been killed in the first place. This macabre pretense was kept up until Turkish authorities provided incontrovertible proof that Khashoggi had been killed. And once Saudi culpability had been established, the regime's strategy revolved around damage control, and specifically to shield the top of the Saudi leadership from any blame. The central focus of Saudi media and public relations efforts rested on the lie that the top man, Mohammed bin Salman, had not only not ordered the murder, but that in fact he was unaware of it. Of course, nobody believed this lie, and the Saudis have had to give up the pretense.
After weeks of lies, false statements, obfuscations, Saudi Arabia finally admitted that the journalist Jamal Khashoggi died a violent death in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. However, their explanation of how he died, claiming he got into a fight, doesn't make any sense. In addition, they demoted several intelligence officials and advisors, seeming to put the blame on the intelligence apparatus. And it seems as though it's an attempt to insulate Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman from further scrutiny or from further inquiry on this matter. We think that the international community needs to get to the bottom of what happened, who called who ordered the hit, where the chain of responsibility lies.
International criticism to Jamal Khashoggi's gruesome murder was muted from the outset. The Turks, who had been monitoring the Saudi consulate in Istanbul round the clock, appeared to drag their feet by selectively feeding damning evidence to the international media. The Turkish approach appeared to suggest a well-thought-out strategy to extract concessions from the Saudis, as opposed to establishing the Saudis' guilt in bringing the perpetrators and those who ordered the killing to account. The Western reaction to Khashoggi's murder was equally muted and ultimately hypocritical. The Washington Post reported on October 10 that U.S. intelligence services had intercepted communications which indicated that the Saudis intended to kidnap Khashoggi from his home in Virginia. Most damning of all, the intercepted communications indicated that the kidnapping was ordered by none other than the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Following the murder, the U.S. did not downgrade its relations with the Saudi regime, despite uproar in the U.S. Congress.
I have zero question in my mind that the Crown Prince, MBS, ordered the killing, monitored the killing, knew exactly what was happening, planned it in advance. If he was in front of a jury, he would be convicted in 30 minutes, guilty. The question is, what do we do about that? So far, it's unfortunate, but I think they feel like this is something that's coming past because the administration has not spoken to this in a way that has spoken to it in a manner that really gives them immunity. And so what the message is to him and those around him is that you can go around killing journalists. Countries like the United States can know beyond a shadow of a doubt that you killed a journalist. And by the way, they, as you know, renditioned other people and tortured other people that have been their dissidents.
The attitude of the other key Western allies, notably the United Kingdom, was broadly similar to that of the Trump administration. The British government condemned Khashoggi's murder, but stopped well short of attributing blame to the Saudi leadership. In fact, the British government continued to conduct business as usual with the Saudis by supplying the regime with arms and expertise to prosecute the war on Yemen.
Every human rights norm at home and abroad. Its government believes that it can kill with impunity journalists or civil rights campaigners, Yemenis or Bahrainis. It funds extremism around the world. But the UK has supplied them with over £4.5 billion worth of deadly weapons.
For Britain and America, Saudi Arabia is a key ally, and it seems no act, however gruesome and deplorable, runs the risk of undermining this alliance.
With all of that being said, though, we have $450 billion, $110 billion of which is a military order, but this is equipment and various things ordered from Saudi Arabia. $450 billion, I think it's over a million jobs. That's not helpful for us to cancel an order like that. That hurts us far more than it hurts them.
One of the most important aspects of Jamal Khashoggi's murder is that it underscored, in graphic and gruesome fashion, the true nature of the Saudi regime. The regime cannot tolerate even the mildest form of criticism, even from erstwhile allies and insiders. MBS was hoping to cultivate a climate of fear by killing Khashoggi and to send out a message that no one is safe, no matter where they live.
This recent killing of Jamal Khashoggi is part of a broader crackdown on dissent that is taking place in the kingdom. And we worry that if the Saudi Arabian authorities get away with this killing of Jamal, then this will send a chilling effect. And obviously, there will be negative consequences to those in Saudi Arabia who dare to speak out.
Hands up, Yemen!
Justice for Jamal!
Whilst this strategy may bear fruit in the short term, by exerting a chilling effect on dissidents and opponents of the Saudi regime, longer term, it is likely to have the opposite effect.
Can't hear you! Stop arming Saudi!
Justice for Jamal!
Well, we've decided to call a protest because we believe that the behaviour of the Saudi regime is unacceptable and extremely dangerous. Clearly, the killing of Jamal Khashoggi was an outrage, and a provocation, actually, which has caused shockwaves around the world. But this takes place against the background of the war on Yemen, which is being led by the Saudi regime, which is causing massive destruction and misery as it is.
Khashoggi's murder by Mohammed Bonesaw Salman is likely to sabotage the morale of Saudi friends, allies, and agents across the globe by making them fear for their own futures.
No democratically elected leader will feel comfortable anymore to have a photo opportunity with Mohammed bin Salman smiling, because it's going to be a heavy burden on him. And we need to keep that alive. We need to keep that pressure, not to allow politicians to do business as usual with the Saudis because of any justification, including, of course, an economic interest or the pretext of keeping the links with Mohammed bin Salman in order to try to push him here and there. These are pretexts that do not work.
Jamal Khashoggi was no saint. He wasn't even a proper journalist. Most of his journalism was a byproduct of his long-standing association with the Saudi Foreign Intelligence Service. There is even suggestion that he had kept up contacts with parts of the Saudi regime right up to his death. It should also not be forgotten that for all of his adult life, barring the last few months, he was an advocate of Saudi foreign policy, including the belligerent and sectarian attitude towards Iran. That said, he didn't deserve that gruesome fate. Part of Khashoggi's legacy is that it has fully exposed Western hypocrisy and double standards on issues such as human rights, the rule of law, and inviolability of national sovereignty.
It was not only my beloved Jamal who was murdered that day, but also democracy, human rights, and freedoms. The failure to punish Jamal's murderers affects us all. Mr. Chair, The truth always wins. History will check note of those who stood with truth and those who did not. Please take action.
Saudi Arabia violated all these norms and values by carrying out a brutal murder in the heart of Turkey's most iconic city. Another major legacy is the demolition of the carefully crafted myth around MBS and his inner circle. When MBS first emerged on the scene in early 2015, he was presented as a reformer and enlightened leader by the Western press.
Mohammed bin Salman's image as a potential reformer has gone down the drain. Therefore, he's not going to be able to sell this soft power aspect of his personality. Therefore, we are presented with the plain fact that we are dealing with yet another smart but very harsh authoritarian leader in the Middle East.
Saudi Arabia has for many years had a horrible human rights record, and many issues have gone unresolved. This unique opportunity, given how much pressure Saudi is under, offers the world community a chance to really zero in on areas that need reform and to push Saudi Arabia to really truly modernize their society, including when it comes to human rights.
MBS has refused to take responsibility for the brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi until now, and instead sacrificed his cronies, including his top aide, Saud al-Ghahtani. He now says he bears responsibility for the murder, as it happened under his watch.
What needs to be investigated is the extent to which the Crown Prince knew or should have known of what would have happened to Mr. Khashoggi, whether he directly or indirectly incited the killing, whether he acted without due diligence, whether he could have prevented the execution when the mission started and failed to do so. These are the range of issues which I believe a follow-up criminal investigation should focus on, along with the liability of other individuals. Over the year preceding the investigation, the execution of Mr. Khashoggi, a number of other human rights violations have been documented and have been denounced. There is no way the leaders of that state, including the Crown Prince, were not aware of those violations. In fact, there is evidence, credible evidence, pointing to their involvement.
MBS's lack of moral courage and fortitude, coupled with his poor judgment and leadership, means that he is now unlikely to succeed his father as king.
Keep in mind that we have a young crown prince. In the past years, he has committed a litany of, I would say, erratic decisions that began with the military campaign in Yemen. He waged a campaign in Yemen, a country where everybody knows that it is impossible to win it, to win its war. So he went to Yemen, he blockaded Qatar, he also apprehended more than 100 Saudi princes and business people, and of course he also ordered the arrest of Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri. So this man has a track of committing irrational acts.
The ghost of Jamal Khashoggi is said to continue to haunt the House of Saud for years to come.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
As pandemic restrictions ease, other respiratory viruses are returning in unexpected ways, says Nicola Jones Ryder in an article published under the heading, Why Easing COVID Restrictions Could Prompt a Fierce Flu Rebound. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The COVID-19 pandemic is continuing to have unusual and unexpected effects on a number of respiratory diseases. Some have been squashed, others have plowed through, and still more are rebounding off-season. These fluxes are complicating medical responses to the pandemic, but also providing scientists with an opportunity to study how these viruses spread. As cold and flu season ostensibly starts in the Northern Hemisphere, researchers warn to expect the unexpected. If anyone tells you they know, they don't know, says epidemiologist John Paget at the Netherlands Institute for Health Services Research in Utrecht. Most agree that influenza will eventually rebound, possibly fiercely, as travel restrictions and societal interventions designed to curb the coronavirus, such as mask wearing, wane. Once we let our good health practices lapse, then flu is likely to hit hard, says Robert Ware, a clinical epidemiologist at Griffith University in Queensland, Australia. Seasonal flu typically kills 290,000 to 650,000 people a year worldwide. But for most of 2020 and 2021, it practically vanished from much of the globe. FluNet, a tool for tracking global virological data on influenza maintained by the World Health Organization, shows that the proportion of positive flu tests has remained roughly flat since April 2020, despite increased surveillance. The United States recorded just 646 flu deaths in the 2020-21 season. The annual average is in the tens of thousands, and there was only one pediatric flu death. Australia has had no seasonal influenza deaths so far in 2021, compared with between 100 and 1,200 in previous years. The decline in flu has persisted despite the variable lifting of social interventions to curb coronavirus. This hammers home the importance of international travel in bringing flu to any given country, says Richard Webby at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. It says a lot about seeding events and how important they are, he says. Flu has continued to circulate at low levels in the tropics, researchers note, so will probably spread from there once borders reopen. Pandemic response measures also seem to have suppressed some bacterial infections, including those that cause pneumonia and meningitis and are associated sepsis. But some viruses have behaved differently. Rhinoviruses, for example, a major cause of the common cold, continue to spread throughout the pandemic. And infections even shot up in some countries, possibly because these viruses aren't as susceptible as many others to measures such as surface cleaning and hand washing, and because they face little competition from other respiratory viruses. There is emerging evidence that these mild viruses might protect people from more serious diseases during infections. And some typical winter viruses have bounced back out of season. Infections caused by common human coronaviruses, another major common cold culprit, and parainfluenza viruses were at very low levels in the United States in 2020, but started to rise to pre-pandemic levels in spring 2021, an unusual time for colds to hit. Likewise, infections with respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, which usually causes mild cold symptoms, but is also responsible for about 5% of deaths in children under 5 worldwide, were at a historic low for a year and then started rising month later than usual. In April 2021, RSV infections were still climbing at the end of August. The strangely timed bumps might be related to school reopenings, according to a report from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, along with a buildup of susceptible unexposed infants in the absence of a vaccine. RSV vaccines are under development. Off-season RSV peaks have been seen elsewhere too, in countries including South Africa, Japan, Australia, and the Netherlands. In Western Australia, and RSV peak in December 2020 was 2.5 times larger than the July peak for 2019. A steep onset of disease doesn't necessarily translate to more cases overall, however. The total number of RSV cases in Queensland was lower than usual. Weir notes, but because all the cases came close together, it was much more intense, putting strain on health resources. It would be worrying to see rebound effects caused by a buildup of immunologically naive people in seasonal flu, researchers caution. Around the world, there are signs of circulating H3N2, H1N1, and B influenza viruses, says Amber Wynn, an epidemiologist in the CDC's Division of Viral Diseases in Atlanta, Georgia. A wave of influenza B infections in winter 2019 to 2020, she notes, contributed to a record number of pediatric flu deaths that season. She says, that's why getting your flu vaccine this season may be especially important.
A simple question.
Principles or profit? That is the question unavoidably directed at Britain as it hosts a global event all about the arms trade. The Defence and Security Equipment International Arms Fair is one of the biggest arms fairs in the entire world. And once again, it's being hosted here in London with the active support of the UK government and with massive companies selling weapons to massive customers.
Many of the customers are entire nations, a number of which violate the very principles that have caused the United Kingdom to go to war in the past, despite the well-worn mantra from government ministers in support of an ethical foreign policy. There is little apparent restriction regarding who attends these arms fairs. This clouds the moral message and angers demonstrators unhappy about the presence of these events. At the same time, Britain's government is in the spotlight for restricting numbers of Afghan refugees permitted to resettle in the UK as they flee instability which the UK helped to cause. If the UK spent even a fraction of the revenue it generates as the world's second biggest arms dealer on refugees, this would go a long way to resolving the migrant crisis. But instead, the profits roll in as the refugees remain excluded as an inconvenient element of the collateral damage caused by conflicts where weapons made or sold in Britain are being deployed.
How does the public feel about the fact that one of the biggest arms fairs in the world is held here in the United Kingdom? And what does this fair say about how seriously the British government really takes its stated goal of an ethical foreign policy? Simple questions with important answers. We put these questions to the public here outside the Defence and Security Equipment International Global Arms Fair. And we began with this. What does an ethical foreign policy really mean to you? Here's what they told us.
Ethical foreign policy, like, surely would be grounded in peace, in sharing, in humanity, in empathy. So a real life case study, I don't know. I know what I have a vision for it to be and what we would all like it to be. And I think that as we become more and more connected across the world, like, we can see the need and the potential for ethical foreign policy, for, you know, no borders, to start considering ourselves as planet Earth and the people of planet Earth, not nations which are fighting and competing against one another when we have such global issues to solve to protect us all. So ethical foreign policy is for everyone.
You know, we don't have anything ethical, foreign policy or anything. We live in an economy that is completely immoral. And capitalism is the economic system that runs the military-industrial war complex. And that means that a whole economy is war, trade war, competition, and poverty and injustice. And Boris Johnson has never knowingly done one good thing in his life. It's all been done out of self-interest, and every politician, every prime minister is a devil and a danger, and they are anti-people, and we are their enemy, and they are my enemy.
Well, an ethical foreign policy to me means that you don't fuel defiance, which means you don't sell weapons, for example, to countries with an abysmal human rights record, that you don't fuel the climate fires by extracting more oil and gas, and that you put humanity first.
Well, the ethically and morally correct thing is not to kill people, in my opinion. And I think that real Jews do not kill people because it's against their religion. Real Christians do not kill people because it's against their religion. And real Muslims do not kill people because it's against their religion. I don't know how an ethical foreign policy could encompass that, because it would seem that we live in a secular society now, and it seems to be okay to kill people.
I was thinking today about a film made by a man called Adam
in 1945, right before he died. And I didn't realize until I saw this film quite how the arms trade and international arms dealing led to essentially the whole latter 20th century of history when it comes to Western foreign policy in the Middle East. I tracked it back to Afghanistan and Charlie Wilson's war and so on, and the Mujahideen and the fight with the Soviet Union over territory in Afghanistan and ruining the Soviet Empire and so on. But I didn't realize it went back that far. And it was so you can track back these arms deals, and really it's the history of those arms deals that explains the state of the world today. Yes, an ethical foreign policy would probably be one that takes that into consideration.
The Defence and Security Equipment International event, held here in London, is one of the biggest arms fairs in the world. What does the public think about that?
We see the very worst aspects of Britain in the technology and the whole military-industrial machine from which we make profit out of the most devastating disasters in other parts of the world. And for me, the most graphic that springs to mind is the fact that the British government has been selling armaments to Saudi Arabia, which is a very rich country, and then those armaments are used to subdue Yemen and bring starvation to a country neighbouring, which is very, very poor. I just don't want to be a part of that. I don't want it. It makes me feel sorry to be English.
It's just a disgrace. It's a disgrace. And it's not only that there is an arms fair going on, it's also to which countries they sell to. Of course, there are some countries that are somehow banned from accessing Western technology, but this list doesn't include terror regimes such as Saudi Arabia, the largest women's prison in the world. And Saudi Arabia is also known for an abysmal human rights record in general, like what they did to this journalist, Khashoggi. They cut him into four pieces.
I've been volunteering in most of the large refugee camps around Europe for the last 4 years, and I've seen the havoc that it's wreaked on populations. I'm half Iranian, my family are from Tehran, and I have met people half my age with multiple bullet wounds, caused by the bullets that are sold by countries such as ours being used on people fleeing war, not even being used during war, but literally children with bullet wounds trying to get to peace. And it has given me quite severe repercussions in my life, where I don't feel like being part of this society and making money for this country anymore, because it just goes towards destruction of life.
So how do people view the reality that Britain welcomes representatives from regimes that it condemns as human rights abusers in order to enable them to buy sophisticated weaponry?
I'm disgusted by it. As a taxpayer, I don't want... You know, I've written to HRMC this year and said I'm not paying any tax. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to be part of Trident. I'm not going to be part of a country that bullies or helps other countries bully people into living the way that they don't want to live. You know, it's disgusting. And, like... We've got so much freedoms in this country, but we're helping oppressive regimes. I don't get it.
Well, certainly Britain doesn't have a great track record in its imperial history to be an arbiter of justice or to be an arbiter of some kind of moral policing on the global stage. So the question is perhaps, certainly for me, look at the resilience of our own country. For instance, we know China has an EMP bomb that's in development, and all of our electricity transformers are made in China. So even here, maybe we're focusing on the wrong issues. As Oliver said, there's a notion of defence and a that the government's first duty is to defend its people. And so perhaps that's not happening in terms of our industrial base. And we're seeing perhaps a descant here of some people selling some sophisticated things. But actually what we need is to investigate what infrastructure we really need in our cities and in our country.
I feel like they say whatever suits them. I mean, they use like human rights as an excuse for going in Afghanistan, but it was nothing to do with human rights. It was about money, and it was about strategic, and it was about the Cold War, and it was about just personal interest. And they'll say that over and over again. Oh, we do this because of this. But if they cared about human rights, they wouldn't be doing this. They'll say what they can to placate the people, but in the end, it comes down to money and self-interest and the status quo and people. I mean, the population seems ready to change that, a lot of them, but a lot of people don't know about it, and the people who are at the top just want to uphold the status quo.
I feel that down. I feel that down about the government. I mean, like, I don't know if you're aware, a month ago, Sadiq Khan, our London mayor, he was against this. He says he's not going to go ahead with it, but obviously it's because it's money, they get the money, so they don't seem to care about lives, they don't seem to care about people's welfare. All they care about is going out there killing people, yeah? They're making deals with people that they're not supposed to be making deal with, like, for example, the Taliban, the Russians, ISIS maybe, who knows. But they are getting, you know, beyond our control.
Well, it's jobs for death, and it's profit for death. And I think that people don't want to buy all this. I mean, to buy an electric car is polluting. That's not a solution. But what I'm saying is that our economies are all so run down that the only thing I think they can sell is bonds to make a profit. And so that's another one of my slogans, don't buy a bomb.
At the moment, our government seems unable to see individual people as people like themselves. We all want to be happy, we all want to be safe, and it seems that our government is too frightened to even look at that possibility. And so they're acting quite reactively rather than with any compassion or insight into the lives of others.
It's clearly total hypocrisy, and I don't want that to be who I am, who my country is. I want to be proud of Britain as part of the global family, and that's not what I experience when I'm here, seeing people coming in and going out of the arms fair.
Let's look at the facts. The value of the arms sector to the UK in 2019 alone was at least £11 billion. As arms companies like BAE Systems promote their bombs, fighter jets and tanks as battlefield tested to potential customers, the Campaign Against the Arms Trade estimates that since 2010, the UK has sold weapons to 51 countries. Of these, 22 are mentioned in the UK government's own Human Rights Watch list, and 26 countries were defined as not free by Freedom House. This has not reduced Britain's involvement. Perhaps astonishingly, arms sales by the UK appear to have increased by 300% since 2018.
Some claim that if Britain actually stopped selling arms globally, customers would simply buy somewhere else. What does the public think about that defence of the UK's involvement?
I think it would be great if we didn't sell them so the blood wasn't on our hands. It's as simple as that. Do you want blood on your hands? If you sold a kitchen knife to a kid in the street and then he went and stabbed someone with it, could you just say, well, he would have got it somewhere else? Well, it's on us. It's on us to do the right thing. And life's all about that. If you don't do the right thing, it has repercussions, the butterfly effect. It goes around the world and we're just creating more hate, more harm. Why, as leaders of the Western world, don't we set a good example?
I'd say, like, well, to start with, we're putting our moral stamp on it. We're saying we're Britain, and we say we're a democracy. And by it being Britain who's given them arms, that we're almost saying that that's okay to them countries. If they got that from somewhere else, that's less legitimate, then that's different. And again, each country has to start. Like, if one democracy says no, well, then how long will it be till the European Union talks about that, till America talks about that? I mean, probably long, but
like the more who say it, the more who will follow. You can't just say like that it happens in other countries, so it has to happen here. And also we sell really, really advanced weaponry. I mean, it's not the same as what some countries can afford to make and sell. What we sell is really brutal and really disgusting.
At the end of the day, if we say to presidents that we don't sell it, maybe other countries will go, hang on a minute, they're not doing it, let's follow suit and follow that. At the end of the day, if they say jump off a cliff, does that mean we jump off a cliff as well? You know, we set the precedent, they follow. Maybe not this time, maybe a year after, who knows? But we have to stand firm and say, look, you know what, this is our policy, this is what we believe in, don't get involved.
If we don't sell them drugs, they will just get the drugs from somewhere else. So should we let any drug dealer run free? And there is an ethical responsibility. Not every country in the world has the capacity to manufacture weapons of this modern terror as Britain does.
I think whatever you do, you should do with integrity and ethically. And if that means not selling, even if another country will make money from it, so be it. The government could, instead of investing in supporting arms companies, could invest in renewable energy, green energy, more sustainable foreign policy, or more sustainable businesses even. And then, you know, maybe people would come and buy those products. Better for everyone.
Well, there are a lot of people that sell a lot of things, and one of the bugs and features of money is that it's a means of universal exchange. You don't get to look at where it goes or where it's come from. And so that's one of the things that we see as very important with regards to blockchain and cryptocurrencies. The notion of, well, can you have a trackable audit trail of what your money has done and where it's going to go afterwards? Can you give parameters as to whether the transactions that are made with your value in future, whether that represents your labor or your capital, can those be ethically moderated in some way? And can you determine those things that your value maybe and may not be used for?
I don't know. People, it's cheaper to pay people not to work because we've got all this debt and everything is. I'll give you an example. The tar sands in America, they are sold at 2% of what it costs to get out of the ground. Everything we make that the Industrial Revolution invented the techniques of how to exploit, everything we make is sold at a fraction. I think everything's sold at about 2%, but just let's say it's only 10%. And so it's actually that debt is the equivalent of the waste and the fact that that it's cheaper to pay people not to work, because every time you eat a piece of bread and pay for it with your, you know, even a piece of bread, you're adding to the debt, because the whole system is rigged to make waste and profit for a few people. So it's cheaper to pay people not to work.
And now a central question. The UK is one of the world's most successful arms exporters. What does this tell us about the government's commitment to an ethical foreign policy?
Well, nobody's got an ethical foreign policy. And the first thing to say regarding war is that there never was a war of defence unless you first had a war of aggression. And so a war makes war. And that is the foreign policy. So war makes war, and our foreign policy and our whole economy is going to kill everybody on this planet. We're going to have wipeout.
Well, I th- I